led the children of Israel on this fantastic trip. The nation had been slaves in Egypt, and Moses had been called by God to lead them out of slavery and back to Palestine, which was described as this land flowing with milk and honey, the promised land. Well, the Egyptians had been rather reluctant to let them go, to say the least. One has a little sympathy with Pharaoh. After all, Moses was suggesting that he would take away an entire cheap labour force from the country. And I'm sure if John Howard had been Prime Minister of Egypt, he would have been quick to point out the economic consequences of this action. I'm sure there were national leaders who could reduce everything to economics in Egypt, just like in Australia. But God sent some plagues and some other things that showed that keeping the children of Israel in Egypt might be worse than letting them go, at least worse for the economy. And so finally the Pharaoh relented just long enough for the Israelites to get away. They got as far as the Red Sea before Pharaoh changed his mind and went after them. And then God parted the waters of the Red Sea long enough for the Israelites to get across and short enough to trap the Egyptian army in the water. On they went into the desert heading for the Promised Land. They got to a place where there wasn't any good water, and God showed Moses how you could use a certain wood to purify the water. And then they moved on and they went to an oasis where there were 12 springs and 70 palm trees, and it was all very lovely and idyllic, and they were obviously enjoying themselves and having a good time. After that, they set off into the desert, and pretty soon they ran out of food. And the people grumbled, so God sent bread and meat from heaven. In another place, God showed Moses how to get water from a rock. A bunch of people called the Amalekites came out, and they fought with the Israelites. And as long as Moses held up his arms, or somebody stuck a stone under them to hold them up, they won the battle. Then Moses went up Mount Sinai to get the Ten Commandments on two stone tablets, which as a child I found just a little bit hard to swallow. My theory is there should be one dad joke in every sermon, you know? So, I mean, as a child I thought, they're so tiny. How did he get five commandments on each of those tablets? Anyway, soon after, if you plug on through Exodus, God sent very, very detailed instructions on how to build the Ark of the Covenant, how to dress the priests, how to build the mobile sanctuary that they called the tabernacle, and so on. And then comes the golden calf incident. Things had been going swimmingly so far, but for some reason, maybe because Moses was away so long up the mountain, copping down all these instructions of the dimensions of the tabernacle tent and the priest's ephod. I mean, did anybody even know what an ephod was before that? I don't know. Anyway, for some reason, the Israelites decided to stop worshipping God, and they built themselves a small god of their own in the shape of a golden calf. Well, Moses wasn't too thrilled about this, and God was even less thrilled. In fact, he said, "I'll burn them all on the spot." But Moses argued with God, and God changed his mind. And he just sent a plague, which was good of him. And Moses had to go back to the chemist for more tablets. And that pretty much brings us up to the point of the story we read today. So what happened today? Well, the Israelites are on the verge of going into the Promised Land. But before they do, God tells Moses, send out a reconnaissance party. So one man is chosen from each family group to go and explore the land, and Joshua and Caleb were among those who went. So the exploration team goes off, and they find a land flowing with milk and honey and pomegranates and grapes and figs and a few people living there, some of whom apparently are rather large and fearsome. In the old translations, it talks about them being giants. The exploration team come back and they deliver their report, and it turns out that the majority report is, "Let's not go. The people who live there are too powerful, their cities are too well fortified, there are too many of them, and they're big." But Caleb and Joshua have a minority report. Caleb says, "Come on, we can do it." And Joshua says the same, "Just do it." It's the first instance of the Nike slogan in the Bible. Well, to cut to the chase, they don't do it. The naysayers win out, the doom and gloom people win the day, the fearmongers carry the argument. And once again, God is not pleased. God had given them an opportunity to have faith in his promise. The promise of a land flowing with milk and honey. And they had instead trusted not God, but their own military assessment of whether they would have a victory. I guess it's one of the earlier historical examples of that truth, that military intelligence is a contradiction in terms. The result? Well, not a single one of the people who decided against going lives to see the promised land. Not one. Over the next 40 years, the Israelites wander the desert, and one by one, all the people who cast a negative vote die off, until only a new generation is left to enter the promised land, under the leadership, by the way, of Joshua, who had argued for them to go ahead 40 years earlier. Well, what is it about change that caused the Israelites to have so little faith in God's promise? Despite having experienced so much evidence of God's faithfulness, wouldn't you think they would have been super faithful people? Instead, when they're faced with opposition, their faith just crumbles. What is it about change that causes our faith to crumble? Let's see if we can get the next slide going. Oh, perfect. This is Machiavelli on change. There is nothing more difficult to plan, more doubtful of success, nor more dangerous to manage than the creation of a new system. For the initiator has the enmity of all who will profit by preservation of the old institutions, and merely lukewarm defenders in those who would gain by the new one. Well, I think one of the built-in barriers to faith for the children of Israel was the very fact that God had looked after them until now. They had water when they needed it. They had bread in the morning and meat in the evening. They'd been opposed in war and survived. They'd found the odd oasis and enjoyed rest. Things were looking pretty good, just as they were, thank you very much. And you want us to go into a strange, unknown land with people we don't know, in fortified towns we aren't certain to conquer, and some of these people are rumoured to be giants anyway? No thanks, I think we'll just stay where we are. Well, what's going on here? I think in every human heart there is a kind of lead weight. It's a kind of inertia. It stops us from moving ahead. It's called the status quo. The way things are, the way they were in the beginning and always have been, world without end. Amen. The status quo. One of the biggest built-in barriers to faith. And as Machiavelli correctly observed, most of us prefer the way things are. And the more comfortable and the more secure we are in the way things are, the more we will oppose any change. Judy and I had lunch last Saturday with Roland and Jan Croucher. Now, Roland and Jan are both Baptist pastors, now more or less retired. Some of you know them quite well. There was a time in their life when they accepted a call to a church in Vancouver, in Canada. Now, Roland and Jan are the kind of people who've overcome their own built-in barriers to change, and Roland decided to change the order of the Sunday service slightly. He decided to move the offering from the middle of the service to the end. He figured the offering at the end would work better as a response to God. But what he didn't realize was that he had challenged a long-standing element of the status quo in that church. You couldn't mess with the order of service. It was just too disturbing to some people who were in power in that church. Indeed, Roland had raised the enmity of all who would profit by preservation of the old institutions, and he had merely lukewarm defenders in those who would gain by the new one. Actually, it led to the end of their ministry there. It's unbelievable, except it's so common, we all know it's true. Another friend told me how he sat in his church vestry meeting, not this one, for a whole night, while the church vestry debated the colour of the pulpit Bible. not the version, not whether it should be King James, New International, the message, something that might reasonably occupy 15 minutes conversation in a church vestry meeting, but whether the Bible should be changed from the traditional black cover to red or green or blue. A whole night's meeting. The status quo. A built-in barrier to our faith. Do you remember the story of Jesus at the pool of Bethesda? This was a pool where the disabled came in hope of a cure. And the idea was that if you were the first to get in the pool when the waters were somehow stirred, you would be cured. And Jesus goes up to one guy who's been sitting there for 38 years. 38 years. And Jesus asks him this question: do you want to be healed? And the guy answers, I have no one to help me into the pool when the water is stirred. While I am trying to get in, someone else goes down ahead of me. Jesus didn't ask him that. Jesus didn't ask him for a commentary on the status quo. He didn't ask him how things were. Jesus asked him, do you want to be healed? But this man, disabled for 38 years, could not see the possibility beyond the way things were. He was stuck in his own status quo. Our desire for the status quo helps to answer the question, what is the built-in barrier to our faith? So the next question is, why is it so? Well, for this we can simply blame the way society works. The way it works to protect the way things are. The way it works to preserve the status quo. And also, I guess, we can blame our parents and the way we're brought up. Throughout childhood, most of us are told that we shouldn't be adventurous. Limits are set for us. Don't go beyond the fence line. Stick to what we know. When did you first hear the proverb, a bird in the hand is worth two in the bush? Bird in the hand is worth two in the bush. Think about this for a moment. A bird in the hand is worth two in the bush. You mean there are two in the bush? How do I get a ticket to the bush? There are two out there. There's only one here in the hand. Similarly, we're taught from an early age not to talk to strangers. Well, okay, it's not a bad rule for kids, I suppose, but why is it that for the rest of our lives, whenever we go into a room full of people, some of them strangers with stories we have never heard, strangers with things to teach us that we have never learned, strangers we have never met, and what do? We look for someone we know. If we never talk to a stranger, would we ever learn anything new? And what about don't reinvent the wheel? Or if it ain't broke, don't fix it. They say that Jack Welch, who was the former chief executive of General Electric, used to say, if it ain't broke, break it. And he used to reorganize the whole of General Electric every few years just to shake it up, just to upset the status quo. Our parents and our society try to teach us that necessity is the mother of invention. But I'm not sure. That's like putting a stop sign on the intersection after the crash. We're going through this now with trains and trucks, aren't we? After the truck collides with the train, there's an outcry to find a prevention. But would it not have been nice if instead of waiting for the necessity caused by the dreadful death toll, someone about 100 years ago perhaps had had the vision to say that one day roads and rails might be a dangerous combination. If someone had said in 1910, we better make sure all these roads and railway tracks are separated by bridges and tunnels. Actually, probably somebody did say that 100 years ago, but they were ignored by people who would profit by preserving the status quo. In the later part of the 1800s, there was a bishop in the United Brethren Church in America who famously railed against attempts by men to build flying machines. The idea of humans being able to fly was an abomination in the sight of God, and to be condemned as the sin of overreaching ambition. Birds were made for the air. Man was made for the earth. If God had meant us to fly, he would have given us wings. On the 17th of December, 1903, this same United Brethren Bishop received a telegram from his sons, Wilbur and Orville, announcing they had succeeded in flying their machine 112 feet. There's a story told of a young man who's walking through the streets of a well-to-do suburb, admiring the grand mansions as he goes. In a meditative mood, he prays, "God, I could never imagine living in a house like that." And he hears God reply, "And that's why you never will." Friends, does our imagination only extend as far as our known universe? Are we locked forever in the status quo? Do things have to be as they ever shall be, world without end? Well, if we understand what our barriers, our built-in barriers to faith are and why they are, the question is, how do we overcome them? Well, first of all, I need to say it's a matter of faith. For our other reading this morning is by way of a benediction from Paul. We'll see the next slide, Jan. And this is what Sandy read to us. "Now to him who is able to do immeasurably more than all we ask or imagine, according to his power that is work within us." First, let's have a look at the second part, which is according to his power that is at work within us. Are we allowing God's power to work within us? Or are we relying too much on our own power? This was something Ken talked about last week, so I'm not going to go over it. But suffice to say that many of us, and myself included, rely too often on our own resources, not enough on God's power to work within us. The other part is the first part, and that is that God is able to do immeasurably more than all we ask or imagine. No matter how much we imagine is possible, God is able to do more, immeasurably more, more beyond our ability to measure. Do you imagine it's possible that you can get the job that you want? God is able to do immeasurably more than you can imagine. Do you imagine we can complete our building project at St. Paul's? God can do immeasurably more. Can we make poverty history? God can do immeasurably more. So the first answer to the how question is one of faith. Do we have the faith that will allow God to do immeasurably more than all we can ask or imagine through the power working within us? The second answer to the how question is about timing. The story of the children of Israel's escape from Egypt is a great example of what happens if you get the timing wrong. There's a right moment and a wrong moment in which to embark on a new enterprise. There's a right time for change and a wrong time. If you get your timing right, you can go on to success. If you miss the moment, you can waste 40 years wandering around in the desert. William Shakespeare said most things better than anyone else, and on the question of getting the timing right, he's most eloquent in Julius Caesar. "There is a tide in the affairs of men, which, taken at the flood, leads on to fortune. Omitted, all the voyage of their life is bound in shallows and miseries." There are moments in our lives when things are rushing along like an incoming tide. Shakespeare suggests that if we take off at these moments of high energy, or the flood, we go on to fortune and success. But if we miss the chance, if we omit to take the opportunity to jump on the tide, we can spend our whole lives stuck in the shallows and in misery. Now, two things are clear about William Shakespeare. The first is that he read his Bible, and he must have known this story about the missed opportunity of the children of Israel. And the second thing is not so well known, nor so obvious, and that is that Will Shakespeare must have been a body surfer. Let me deal with the body surfer first, because you won't hear anything else until I do, probably. I love body surfing. I had grandparents who lived at this beach, north of Ochre Beach on the central coast of New South Wales. Now, north of Ochre Beach, as you can see, is nestled up against a rocky headland. And this causes the waves to break in a certain pattern early and to form the ideal conditions for surfing. You'll see all that surf there that's white. Now, I didn't much like the surf until I was five, but then I lived in it for the next 10 years. I joined the lifesaving club. I learned to ride a surfboard. In those days, they were nearly 10 feet long and they're about as manoeuvrable as the Queen Mary. But best of all, I learnt to body surf. Now, it's clear from what Shakespeare wrote that he also was a body surfer. Because there is a right moment and a wrong moment to catch a wave in the surf. I see one or two of you going, that's good. Most inexperienced surfers seem to think you catch the wave when it breaks. This is wrong. No, the right moment to catch a wave is just before it reaches its full height. You catch a wave on the way up. The trick is to time your swimming to reach the same speed as the wave just in the moment before the wave reaches its full height. If you time it right, you're in for a great ride all the way to the beach. If you time it wrong, you spend the next few moments dumped into the shallows because you were too early and the wave broke on top of you, or you spend the next few minutes in miseries because the wave sails right past you and leaves you pretending you actually pulled out at the last minute. Stars weren't properly aligned, looked a bit green. Well, as William Shakespeare also knew, this is what happened to the Israelites. They were going full steam ahead out of Egypt. Now was the moment, while they were in full flight, enjoying success, at the top of their game, like Hawthorne on Friday. Sorry. And what happened? They blew it. They blew it. The Israelites failed the faith test. Despite God having done immeasurably more than they could have asked or imagined, they simply did not have the faith to follow it through. Worse, they missed the moment, and it cost them not just 40 years, but a whole generation of wasted lives and wasted time. Friends, let us not be the generation that dies in the desert. If God's calling us to have faith in his plans for us, let us not fail to get going while the going's good. Amen.